Lazarus through, there was nobody as great, as mighty, as magnificent in the day as King Ahasuerus, the king of the Persians. His wife was a beautiful queen by the name of Vashti. And King Ahasuerus had been at the table long, and many of his royal companions were there as well. And as they continued to party and probably drink beyond excess, the king made an order to his queen, "Come to my presence and dance before us." We're not entirely sure what the king's order meant. We don't know if the king's order meant to come before him and his friends and display in some particular kind of way a lewdness that was simply not in her nature to do. We don't know exactly what her reason was, but she refused the king's command. How could anybody refuse King Ahasuerus? From India to Ethiopia, his word was law. If he gave a decree, all would obey, and none of his decrees could ever be abated. How dare she? She owes her life to the king. How dare she refuse his command to come before his presence? As he counseled with his friends around the table, "What should we do?" His friend said, "Well, king, there is no way that you can overlook Queen Vashti's disobedience. In fact, if you do overlook her disobedience, it will give some kind of confidence to all the women of the kingdom that should any of their husbands find themselves having disobedient wives, that that'll be okay in the kingdom, because they can all look to Queen Vashti and say, well, the queen disobeyed her husband, why do I have to disobey mine? So king, you cannot let this disobedience by Queen Vashti go unpunished. You must punish her." Queen Vashti was removed from her position as queen. The king divorced her. She was set in exile away from him. All of her royalty stripped. All of her privilege stripped. All of her servants stripped from her. She was not outcast. And the message was very clear. If you cross King Ahasuerus, even if you are the queen, you too will meet a very unpleasant state. No king can be without a queen. And so King Ahasuerus began a search in all of his kingdom from India to Ethiopia to find the most beautiful queen upon whom he could place the crown of the kingdom and declare to everyone everywhere, "Look at my queen." Of course, as you could imagine, women from all over began to present themselves at the king's palace. And orders were given to the king's servants. Wherever you happen to go, should you come across a woman of striking beauty, bring her to my presence. Maybe she will be the one to be my queen. As the search continued and all the unmarried women were examined, those who had been brought to him, one individual stood out from all the rest. Her dark hair shimmered, seemingly brighter than everyone else's. Her black, dark eyes glowed more prominently than any others. Her cheeks were full, her lips were full, her figure was to be admired, her grace so much superior than every other woman who was there. They brought her before the king. The king took a look, and her features were so obviously superior to every other woman whom he'd met that he identified her as the one who would be his next queen. The ceremony took place. The coronation was arranged, and he took the crown which previously was worn by his queen Vashti, and he placed it on the head of his new queen, the young girl Esther. Esther's history is really quite fascinating. She was an orphan, you see. Her lineage is Jewish, and she was now raised by her older cousin, a man by the name of Mordecai, whom she regarded as her uncle. Mordecai loved Esther. Unmarried as he was, a eunuch serving in the palace of King Ahasuerus as one of the stewards, much like Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in times previously. Here now, Mordecai serves in the court of King Ahasuerus as one of the members of his court. Esther now has risen to queen in this very same court. And both of these, though, Jewish people rising to this position of prominence in the kingdom of Persia is quite unheard, and they kept their lineage to themselves. No one knew that Esther was a Jew. Day after day, as Mordecai went in and out of the palace, he heard things. You know how it is, just like you hear things at work, and every now and then you hear somebody complain about a supervisor. Well, there were two men in the court who were complaining about King Ahasuerus. And they were thinking a whole lot more than simply not doing their jobs well or going on strike. They plotted to murder, to assassinate King Ahasuerus. And Mordecai got wind of this and overheard it. Of course, the relationship that he continued with his cousin, his cousin Queen Esther, the relationship that he continued with her, he got word to her, Queen, know that these two men are about to plot to assassinate King Ahasuerus. The queen, in one of her visits to her husband, the king, notified him of the plot against him and did so in Mordecai's name. She didn't identify that Mordecai was a relative, just simply said, I've heard from one of the servants of the house, a man by the name of Mordecai, one of your faithful and loyal servants, that these two other men are plotting to assassinate you. The king, of course, called the two individuals in, discovering that indeed the plot was true, ordered them executed. Execution by the kings at this point in time was rather gruesome in Persia. They impaled the victims, normally on some kind of tall wooden object, maybe similar to a cross. It's believed that it's the Persians themselves who initiated what we recognize as the crucifixion. They would impale the body of the criminal upon this particular object at a high point in the city for everyone everywhere to see and observe. Everyone would know this individual crossed the king. Beware. And that was done to these two would-be assassinators. In the king's court, of course, are many servants. His chief of staff was a man by the name of Haman, a man quite full of himself. A man who made it the policy, as he would go about the king's palace, or if he were to be about the king's grounds, if you were to engage Haman in passing, you were to bow to him as he made his way. And of course, this happened every day without end. This person would come by, they would bow to Haman, and then he would come by and they would bow to Haman, and everyone bowed to Haman, with the exception of one man. That's right, Mordecai. When Mordecai would see Haman, he would stand up tall and erect and walk right by him. And it bugged Haman to no end. He wasn't satisfied that 99.9% of the palace bowed to him at every passing. It just completely saturated his mind that Haman would not bow to him. And he hated Haman. And Haman's hatred goes back, though, more than just Mordecai's refusal to bow. In fact, here is what we know about Mordecai and Haman. Mordecai He is from the tribe of Benjamin. You might remember that the tribe of Benjamin gave Israel its first king, a man by the name of Saul, who was from the family of Tish. Mordecai is one of those descendants. His ancestor, many generations back, is Tish, David, Saul's father. And do you remember on one occasion when Saul got in big trouble with the prophet? Samuel had given Saul the order to kill all the Amalekites at God's decree. They came and Samuel met the king. His name was Agag. And Samuel couldn't understand why the battle had taken place and King Agag was still alive. And there was Saul over there, and he said, "Saul, why have you left these sheep and cattle and this king alive?" And you remember Saul said it was because of the people. King Agag was spared by Saul, but you'll remember that Samuel came on the scene. He drew the king's sword and he finished the task that the king was supposed to do, killing the enemy of God, King Agag. One of the descendants of King Agag is the man Haman. Their hatred for each other goes back many, many, many generations. That Mordecai, this descendant of Saul, who butchered King Agag, that he would not bow to Haman was a horrible affront to Haman. He hated him all the more. And Haman resolved in revenge that he was going to destroy Mordecai and all the Jews as well. You'll remember that the Jews now occupy Persia because of what happened many years previous. You see, in our understanding of timeline, we're past the time of Daniel now. You'll remember when we studied Daniel just a few months ago? Daniel's at least 50 or 60 years in the rearview mirror. 70 years prior to that, you of course will remember that King Nebuchadnezzar came to Judah and he ransacks Judah and he takes back to Babylon, where King Ahasuerus now rules. He takes back to Babylon all of those who were of the choicest people, individuals like Daniel and his friends Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and so many, many others like it. And Mordecai is a descendant of some of those people as well. And Mordecai and so many, many other Jews are now dispersed, not only in and around the capital of Susa, but are dispersed around the entire empire, from India to Ethiopia, as God kicked them out of the land. Mordecai, as a Jew, and Haman is an angry man who hates the Jews, Haman devises a plan where he will make a deal with King Ahasuerus to simply wipe out all of the Jews. And so Haman does what was done in the day, and he began to cast lots, maybe taking something like modern day dice and rolling those until a certain number appeared, and he was looking for the lucky day. What day should we set aside as the day to exterminate all of the Jews empire-wide? When the lot fell on a certain day, he then approached King Ahasuerus. And he said to King Ahasuerus this, "King, there is a group of people in your kingdom who do not follow our ways, who are not interested really in following our statutes. I would like to propose that on this particular day," and he named the day that was identified by the casting of the dice, "I'd like to suggest on this particular day that you issue a decree to eliminate all of those people." And he named the Jews. King Ahasuerus, having no love lost for the Jews, agreed with Haman. Haman said, "And oh, by the way, I'll put into your coffers 30,000 talents of silver, a significant amount of money to enrich the king's holdings." The king signed the decree. He gave it his stamp of approval. And you'll remember from our study in the book of Daniel that according to the law of the Medes and Persians, A law which the king signs cannot be revoked. Word began to filter out. It was many, many months until this lucky day. Word began to filter out among the king's servants and eventually reached Mordecai's ears that the day was coming when the king had authorized the empire-wide killing of every Jew, man, woman, boy, girl, all of them extinguished forever. Mordecai, hearing the news, knowing the plight of his people, instead of wearing his fine royal garments, dressed in clothes of mourning, widely recognized by anyone that was there that something was desperately wrong with Mordecai, he sent word to his cousin, Queen Esther. The queen invited him in, and Mordecai told the queen of the plot against their people. And Mordecai reminded the queen that even though you are a queen, Esther, you are still a Jew. And don't think that when your lineage is discovered that you will be spared. You have to use your position of influence to stop the king from executing this decree. Queen Esther said to Mordecai, go back and ask the people to fast for 3 days, and I'll consider my options. He reminded Queen Esther that it may be that you were born for such a time as this. The queen said to Mordecai, my problem is this. I would happily talk to the king, but the king has not invited me into his presence for 30 days now. Who knows? Maybe she wondered if the king was no longer as pleased with her as he was the first time he saw her and made her the queen. And she wondered if her acceptance would be received or not. Because if you went uninvited to King Ahasuerus' throne, the king, in order to identify those who might be traitors or assassins, if you were acceptable, he would motion with his staff or his scepter towards you. If you were unacceptable, he would motion in another way, and those servants of the house would immediately execute you on the spot. For her to go before King Ahasuerus was a risk of her own life, to which Mordecai reminded her, well, if you do not die there, you'll die when the decree is executed. As she thought and as she considered her options, she decided she would make her way before the king. She made herself look as beautiful as possible. Her attendants identified her best gown, her finest jewels. They made her appearance to look as best or better than it ever had before. And she approached the king's throne. Queen Esther, to see you, O king. Did I invite Esther to come see me? No, Your Highness, you haven't. The moment of truth. Shoulders back, she enters the king's throne. She pays homage to him. And she says, O king, if it would please. He raised his scepter in acceptance and said, O Queen Esther, what would you desire for me to do for you? Name it. I'll be happy to do anything for you. She said, king, would you come tomorrow to a dinner party that I'm throwing? You and me, and would you bring your chief of staff, Haman, with you? I'd love for him to be a guest as well. The king said, queen, I would love to come. We'll be there. The preparations began. The banquet hall was made for the arrival of the royal family. The king and the queen were having this private dinner party as well. And you can only imagine Haman's delight. Haman, who loved to have everyone bowing to him, to be invited as the only guest at the dinner between the king and the queen. He went home and he told his wife, can you imagine such a thing? I have been invited. And of course his wife plotted his rise within the king's eyes. And oh, he is so pleased with you. And they went to the banquet, the three of them dined together. And the king, knowing that Esther had something more in mind than simply coming to dinner, said, Queen Esther, you know I'll give you anything up to the half of my kingdom. What is it that you want? She said, O king, would you come again to another dinner tomorrow and bring Haman too? The king left, Haman left, Haman went home to his family and said, can you believe this? Not only was I invited today, she invited me back tomorrow. Nobody else in the whole of the kingdom except me. His wife and his servant said, oh, they must intend to display upon you some measure of incredible prestige. They're going to do something for you that is absolutely wonderful and amazing. You see, Mordecai previously and Haman, you'll remember, not getting along real well. That night, the king had a dream. Back up. That night, the king, unable to dream, unable to sleep, called his servants in and said, would you read the book of history to me? They opened the book and they began to read in the book of history about the event that Mordecai did in saving the king's life some years previous. And the king said, what should be done for such a man? What should we do for him? They lauded him before everyone. Haman had to lead the animal that was bearing Mordecai through the streets. Haman hated Mordecai. Couldn't wait for him to be killed. His wife said to him, why don't you build one of those scaffoldings where you impale people and put it at the highest point, maybe on top of one of the biggest buildings here in Susa. And then when Mordecai is hanging impaled on that, you'll get your revenge. They came back to the second dinner party. They enjoyed a feast together. The king and the queen laughing, enjoying, eating, reveling in each other's company. Haman there as well. And King Ahasuerus knowing his queen. Queen Esther, what is it that you desire? Because you know I'll give it to you up to the half of your kingdom. To her king husband, she said, O king. And she revealed her lineage, her ethnicity, that she was a Jew. And she said, a decree has gone out against your people, against me. This man, Haman, and she denounced Haman in front of the king's presence. This man would seek to kill my own life also. Ahasuerus immediately left the dinner party and went out into the garden to think. And now Haman was left alone with Queen Esther. And he began to plead. In fact, he was so expressive in his exclamations. He crossed a boundary that he should not have crossed. And he approached Queen Esther and he got very close and intimate into her presence, begging her for her forgiveness. Please spare my life. And in this moment, the king entered the room and said to everyone, will he now abuse my wife in my very own presence? He ordered Haman taken out from the presence of the queen and the king. And they impaled his body on the very same scaffold that Haman had set up for Mordecai days earlier. But of course, there still is the problem of decree. What could be done? The laws of the kings of the Medes and the Persians cannot be taken away. So the king authorized a second decree, allowing anyone of Jewish heritage to fight against those who would seek to kill them. And he said, you will have as assistance to you anyone within my kingdom to help you. All of my soldiers will be at your aid. The day of reckoning came. And on the day of reckoning, instead of Jewish lives being slain, those who would seek to kill their lives were taken. A great victory was won. Mordecai and Esther's people were spared. Mordecai was given Haman's holdings, all of them, and he continued to rise in prominence within the kingdom. Esther and her people began to hold a new festival. The festival was not one of the original ones which was given in the Mosaic Law, but like Hanukkah, was one of only two that are celebrated by Jewish people to this day. It's called the Festival of Purim, when the people of Israel remember their escape from the hand of King Ahasuerus. King Ahasuerus would reign more years, and Mordecai as well, and both of them would continue in great prominence in the kingdom. That story comes from the book of Esther in the Bible. If you heard Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu this week at the end of his speech before the United States House of Congress, he referenced this book. And he said, this week, my people will be celebrating the feast and the festival of Purim. And at that particular time, Jews across the globe celebrated when the people of Israel were saved from the decree made by King Ahasuerus at the prompting of the wicked Haman to annihilate Esther and Mordecai and all of the people. And across the globe, Jewish families will eat meals together. They will exchange gifts with one another. They will donate charities to each other. And they will read the book of the Bible, Esther, reminding each other of the story that Netanyahu referenced. When you read the book of Esther, there are some astonishing points to note, but I want to bring this one to your attention as the most significant. The most unique feature about the book of Esther in comparison with virtually every other book in the Bible is that nowhere is there a reference to the name of God. It is entirely absent. Mordecai does not reference God. Queen Esther does not reference God. Whoever it is that wrote the book of Esther, the narrator, he does not reference God. Instead, what we see in the book of Esther is the idea that God is there, but his name is not uttered by any of the speakers. It is not expressed in any way at all in any of the 10 chapters. In fact, when you read the book of Esther from chapter 1 to chapter 10, there is no direct religious teaching at all. There's no reference to any of the 10 commandments. There's no reference to any of the Mosaic Law. There's no reference to any of the Psalms, any of the wisdom of Proverbs. There's no reference to any activity by God done through any prophet or through any king. There's no remembering of King David and his slaying of Goliath, and maybe God will spare us in that way. There's no reference of the people crossing the Red Sea, and maybe God will spare us that particular way. There is no direct teaching of religion or God at all in the book of Esther. In fact, there is not even a mention of prayer. When Esther says to Mordecai, go tell the people to fast for 3 days, that's all she says. She doesn't say what we would normally say, fast and pray. Now it's true that Esther and Mordecai, they exhibit amazing patriotism. They exhibit incredible unselfishness. They exhibit a readiness to risk everything to right wrongs. But what is missing from the book of Esther, if you did not know more than what is here, is what is the moral strength behind what they do? Someone could read Esther like I have no doubt that many people did this week. Someone could read the book of Esther and be unfamiliar with the God of the Bible and just marvel how amazingly things worked out. Wow, can you see how coincidentally it all came to good? They might use words and phrases like, wow, they were really fortunate. Isn't it lucky for Mordecai that the night that he couldn't sleep when he had insomnia and his historians began to read from him to the king from a book that they read from the exact story about Mordecai sparing the life of the king by uncovering the plot against him? Wasn't Mordecai lucky that he read from that? Readers of the book of Esther might elevate the bravery of the queen or the backbone of Mordecai. But you in the gathering this morning, you are not a reader unfamiliar with the God of the Bible. Instead, you see in every nuance of the story of Esther the hand of God behind it. So I want to give you these three ideas as we close this morning. One, marvel at the omnipotence of God. To do what? To orchestrate each event and each individual to accomplish His purposes. So over these next few weeks together as we study the book of Esther, and as you and your time away from here, when you are reading and Monday through Saturday and you open to some part of the book of Esther, marvel at the omnipotence of God to orchestrate each event. Like what? Like the choosing of Esther herself. Was Esther the most beautiful woman in the whole of the kingdom? To somebody's eyes, but maybe not to another person's eyes, but definitely to King Ahasuerus' eyes, and that's the only eyes that mattered, right? What prompted him to look at her and say, that's the one I want? With every detail in the book of Esther, marvel at the omnipotence of God to orchestrate each event and each individual to accomplish His purposes. So that as you're reading the book of Esther, you see these secondary causes that make things happen, but you know that that is not the ultimate cause. The first cause is the God of heaven Himself. And then make those applications to yourself, brothers and sisters. In a world of crazy events, made all the more crazy by the ease of information, that the God of heaven is omnipotent in the orchestration of the event of every person and every detail in the book of Esther, that should comfort us. It should prompt in us a resistance to any thought and every thought that leaves God out of the events of your life. As you read the book of Esther, marvel in your own life, moment by moment by moment, at what God is doing. Even when you don't see the hand of God apparently, marvel at that. His omnipotence is on display. He is exercising the wisdom of His power in the affairs of your life, moment by moment, day by day, for His glory and for your good, in the same way that He did in the book of Esther. See this. Marvel at the faithfulness of God. Marvel at His faithfulness to fulfill His covenantal promises to a people not upholding their end of the agreement. I alluded to it earlier. You'll remember why the people are not in and around Jerusalem anymore, because God kicked them out of the land. Why did God kick them out of the land so many years previous? He kicked them out of the land because He had had it with their betrayals. Over and again, they worshiped false gods. They broke the covenant made between Him and them at Mount Sinai. He had remained faithful to them. They had become unfaithful to Him. He had promised to them two things. You remain faithful to Me. You can dwell in the land. I will provide and protect and take care of everything for you. The second problem was this. If you go a-whoring after false gods, then I will kick you out of the land. God kept both ends of the promise. Marvel at His faithfulness to fulfill His covenantal problems to a people not upholding their part. So now in the book of Esther, we are at least 50 years after the time of Daniel. Can I remind you what happens at the end of the book of Daniel? Remember that? Daniel says, okay, 70 years are up. It's time to go back. But then we get to the book of Ezra, written about the time of Esther, and the people aren't wanting to go back. They want to stay in Babylon because we kind of like being Babylonians. We're not really interested in being Jews anymore. We kind of like being worldly. We're not always interested in being Christians. They don't belong here. Mordecai does not belong in Persia. Esther does not belong here. The Jews who are scattered throughout the empire do not belong where they are. They have been invited and commanded by previous kings to return. God has opened His arms and said, come back. The expulsion is over. And they said, we kind of like it where we are. There's no worship of Him. There's no remembrance of the Passover. There's no reading of the sacred texts. There is no singing of the Psalms. It's all gone. As evidenced by not one single reference to God or religion in the whole of the book of Esther. And yet, God chooses to remain faithful to a people who are not upholding their end of the bargain. Now, Christian brothers and sisters, embrace His faithfulness to you too, when you are less than faithful to Him. He has not left you, and He will not leave you, despite your return to the sin which so easily besets you. Should we sin that grace can abound? God forbid. But when we do sin, when we are unfaithful, remember what He says. If we will confess, He is faithful and just to forgive us our sins and to cleanse us from all unrighteousness. Marvel at the faithfulness of God. And then this one. Marvel at the mercy of God. Not to execute judgment on His and on this rebellious people. God would have been completely justified to allow the execution to take place. Had He turned His eye away and allowed Haman's plan and King Ahasuerus' edict to go forward, God would have been completely justified. The Bible teaches us it is only because of the Lord's mercies that we are not consumed. The Bible tells us that if God should count iniquities, who can stand? Marvel at the mercy of God. This is the gospel. The gospel of Jesus Christ is this, that you and I are rebels against God, wanting nothing to do with Him. And what we do want to do with Him, we want it on our own terms. We are sinners. We are left undone. All of our righteous deeds are nothing more than filthy rags. Instead, we are sinners by choice, every single one of us, and the wages of our sin is death. But the gift of God is eternal life through Jesus Christ our Lord. Marvel at the mercy of God. Christian brother, Christian sister, tell the gospel to yourself over and again. God has been merciful to you. Friend, you're in the gathering today. Do you know, have you experienced God's eternal mercy? Do you know that you stand condemned before God, awaiting eternal judgment in a real place called hell? But God is merciful to the extent that He has offered you forgiveness of your sin if you will agree with Him, I am a rebel against you. And I can't be right with you by my own good deeds. But you sent your Son to be my Savior by paying the price for my sin on the cross. Would you save me because of what Jesus did? And He will be merciful to you, a sinner, just like He has been merciful to me, a sinner. This is the God of Esther. Bow before Him. Would you pray together with me, please?